pleasure to have Dr. Harry G. Phillips here with us to speak on the question, does astronomy point to design? Harry did his doctorate in astrophysics at Cornell University. He came to the Biblical Theological Seminary, did his Master of Divinity here. His wife went over to Israel for a number of years, and he did a M.A., is that right? M.A. in Hebrew at what's now called the Jerusalem University College. Has taught on the college level, is currently full-time in writing and reading and speaking, etc. We're going to welcome him to speak this evening to us on Does Astronomy Point to Design?
Thank you very much. I was full-time working, but my company, like so many other companies, also downsized, and as a result of that, I am now working on this kind of material. Appreciate your coming out. I started a talk called Does Astronomy Point to Design? And when I got into it, I started with the solar system and looking at matters of the solar system that have to fit together that look as though the solar system is designed. But I was going to be a little bit more ambitious. I wasn't going to look at the solar system only. I wanted to look at the universe as a whole, at the cosmos, the forces in the universe, how they fit together, etc., 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 and saw that this is an enormous, enormous subject. So I changed my title a little bit to Does Astronomy of the Solar System Point to Design? And that's where the solar system come in. I noticed when Bob first came in, he looked at the screen and did a double take and said, wait a minute, I thought this was going to be on the solar system. This is the second slide. This is what I did not have up. So Does Astronomy of the Solar System Point to Design? One might ask, why even bother to look for design? One thing, I think it's safe to say, an unbiased observer looking at the world sees so many things fitting together that it looks designed. Now that, in and of itself, isn't a reason to believe it's designed, but I would say it looks designed, and one would like to know who the designer is, if indeed the universe is designed. Also for Christians, to those who believe in Christ, it tells us something about God. I'm firmly convinced that we have two revelations that God has given us. One is what we call the Bible. The other is what we call His revelation in nature, special revelation and general revelation. And it's interesting to see how those things fit together. So the study of both gives us a more comprehensive view of who God is and what He has done, rather than just studying either one or the other. Also, we might ask the question, why do we consider astronomy? And one reason I would say is a fascinating subject in its own right. I was very young. I think it was about second grade when I decided I really wanted to go into astronomy. That was after wanting to be a train engineer, because that was back when you had coal fire engines coming by our house and waking us up at night and everything. I was, wow, this would be cool. I could go on a train and go hundreds of miles even at very fast speed, you know, 60 miles an hour or something like that. And about second grade, I began to get interested in the stars, in astronomy, even at that young age. So second grade, that would have made me about 12 years old. So, no, I'm only kidding. At about seven, I decided I wanted to go into astronomy, and I was this way for a couple years. And finally, my dad said, you know, he's getting pretty serious about this. I better figure out what astronomy is. I remember at one time he took me aside, and after having read up on it, he says, do you realize that astronomers basically spend a lot of time up on mountaintops, cold mountaintops, and they don't make a whole lot of money? Are you sure you still want to go into this? And lo and behold, I wound up getting my degree in it after making a circuitous route about other things. But it is a fascinating subject in its own right. I think it also encourages ultimate questions. I don't know where I got this particular quote, where it says, it's impossible for any sensitive person to look at a star-filled sky without being stirred by thoughts of creation and eternity. The mystery of the origin and destiny of the universe haunts us throughout our lives. And now you're probably going to say, what does he think? We're idiots? We can read this for ourselves. However, there are certain people who are going to listen to the tape that are not going to be able to read it. So forgive me if I read things because we're taping the talk. Also, Scripture encourages it. I think Scripture encourages us to take a look at the universe around us. Here's a famous scripture verse, Psalm 19. Tells us that the universe tells us something about God, and look at what part of the universe. The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of His hands. And then goes on to tell us that it preaches to us day and night in a language that we can all understand. Psalm 8 shows us our worth. And notice that this comes again by looking at the heavens. When I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon, the stars, which you have set in place, what are people that you are mindful of them or their children that you care for them? So again, by looking at the heavens, we find out something about the way God feels about us and something about ourselves. Psalm 104 shows us God's providential care. The first part really deals with the earth, about how he waters the mountains and provides the food for the animals of the earth, how he provides wine that glads the heart of human beings, oil to make their face shine, etc. And then also one verse says the moon to mark off the season. The sun knows where to go down. And it's really with the seasons that we get the food for our table, etc. And so it becomes a very... astronomy becomes a place where we can look to see something about God. But there's also a disclaimer here, not a disclaimer, but also a warning, I should say, that comes from Romans chapter 1, starting about verse 18. It shows us how much value God puts on general revelation. In this sense, where it says, the wrath of God is being revealed against those who suppress the truth by their wickedness, for what may be known about God is plain to them, God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that all are without excuse. And I'm sure this goes back to the Psalm 18, Psalm 8, Psalm 19, Psalm 8, etc., Psalm 104, where all this thing should have enough of an impact on us so we should be able to discover something about God. So at the end when we say, wait, I didn't hear anything about God, nobody told me about him, there's really going to be no excuse. And this part of the revelation comes through us in nature. And so there's something there. So before starting, here's my disclaimer. We will discuss some physics. I don't know if this person is happy we're going to discuss physics or not happy that we're going to discuss physics, but we'll discuss it on the level that, Lord willing, will be understandable. What we want to do is take a look at the Earth, and we want to ask ourselves, what has to be right about Earth in order for life to exist on it for the length of time that it has existed on the Earth? It appears that very early life began on Earth as early as 3.8 billion years ago, although I've seen some indications now. It may actually go to about 4.2. Everybody agrees 3.2 billion years ago life existed on Earth. Some push it to about 3.8, some are trying to push it for about 4.2. All right, so what's a billion years? A billion here, a billion there, as Everett Dirksen said, pretty soon you got real money that you're talking about. At any rate, the question is, what has to be right about Earth for life to exist that long? What keeps the Earth from being too hot or too cold for life? What are some of the catastrophes that can occur that can wipe out life? In order to have life existing on Earth, even elemental life existing on Earth, you've got to have a fairly stable system. And to think of all the things that make the Earth stable over the course of 3.2 to 4.2 billion years for life to have been here are pretty amazing. And the kind of things that we want to look at are given here in this particular menu. We're going to find that the Earth is just in the proper location, not only with respect to the Sun, but with respect to our galaxy. It has just the right mass, otherwise catastrophic things can happen if the Earth is too massive or not massive enough. We're going to see how plate tectonics has actually helped us in terms of keeping the carbon dioxide level at reasonable levels here on Earth over these millions and billions of years. I'm going to say a few things about water. We're going to see how the tilt of the axis has been stabilized by a very interesting method in order to keep the, because the tilt of the Earth has a lot to do with the intensity of the seasons on the Earth. I'll say something about the presence of a right-sized moon and tell you a very interesting story, if I remember, that one astronomer from Germany told us one time. We have just the right kind of star that provides the energy over a stable period in order to have life on Earth. And then finally, you may not think that life on Earth really depends at all on massive planets that we have in the outer part of the solar system, but we'll find that Jupiter and Saturn actually have an influence to the good as to life existing on Earth. So that's the menu that we're going to take. First of all, the Earth's location. Well, I don't know exactly where we are. But not only so far in terms of the location in the solar system, want to take a look at the solar system and see where it's located in our galaxy. This is not our galaxy. We haven't got out this far yet to get pictures like this, but if we could get out far enough from the Milky Way, this is the way it would look. With a head-on view on the right and a side view over on the left, the galaxy has about 400 billion stars, or billion stars, whichever way you want to say it, and the galaxy is about 100,000 light years across in diameter, so the radius is about 50,000 light years, and from the center out, something around 26, 27,000 light years is where we are located. So on the picture on the left, we'd be located about here in what is known as the plane of the galaxy. And if you were to take a look at the top view, we would be, again, about 27 or so thousand light years away from the center in an offshoot of one of these spiral arms. You say, well, so what? Well, here's a so what. First of all, the center of the galaxy is an extremely, extremely formidable place to live. There are an incredible number of stars. There are an incredible number of stars that are dying and producing supernovas. These are enormous explosions. I'll show you a Hubble picture of one in just a moment. But these particular, the nucleus of the galaxy is a very vicious place to live. Stars are colliding. Stars are dying. They are giving off an enormous number of X-rays and gamma rays, which would kill life if the Earth was too close to these. Not only that, but there's so much density, so much material in the center, that the gravitational influence on the Earth from being surrounded by so many stars would be such that you would not have a stable orbit about our sun for a very long period of time. So the center of the galaxy is not the place to be. I would say, all right, boy, yeah, now that you told me that, I'm going to get as far away as I can. Well, here's the interesting thing. You don't want to be too far away from the center of the galaxy. You really want to be out on the spiral arm. You don't want to be way over here, for example. And the reason is, again, supernovas. You say, wait a minute, first you told me supernovas are dangerous. Now you're telling me I don't want to be in a place where there aren't enough supernovas. What in the world is going on here? Here's what's happening. Just to give you a feeling for how powerful supernovas can be, here's a supernova, one star, that explodes, that for a couple weeks can give as much energy as an entire galaxy. So we're talking about a star who in a couple weeks can give as much energy as 400 billion stars. Well, you can imagine you don't want to be too close to something like that. Not only can you get blasted to smithereens, but the X-rays and the gamma rays and what have you that are given off by the explosion also will totally wipe out life. However, oh, by the way, here's a picture of a supernova explosion, a remnant, and a very fine Hubble picture of it. But here's what's so interesting about supernovas. Supernovas are the only way we know of to create the heavy elements in the universe that are necessary for life. Then what about the Big Bang? The Big Bang creates hydrogen, it creates helium, some lithium, perhaps there was some beryllium around. That's it. We need more than hydrogen. We're certainly not going to use helium because it's inert gas. What do we need? Carbon, nitrogen, along with some of the oxygen. We need phosphorus, silicon. We need iron for our hemoglobin. Where does it all come from? It didn't come from the Big Bang. Where did it come from? Answer, it came from supernovas. And basically, large stars, huge stars, have the ability to cook the elements in their interior to progressively heavier and heavier stages. So you can start out with a star that's composed of hydrogen and helium, and through various processes, you can cook all the elements that are shown down here. Not only the hydrogen and the helium in the outer part of the star, but in the interior, you can have carbon and oxygen and neon and silicon and sulfur and iron. And the process of the supernova is once the core gets to iron, a process occurs where the supernova absolutely explodes. Now, what happens to all this good stuff that's in the middle of the supernova? It gets spread out to the surrounding area, surrounding region, which has gas and dust clouds that at one time were hydrogen and helium, but now have all this other stuff in it as well. Out of those swirling gas clouds, eventually you get processes whereby stars and planets form, And what are you going to find on the planets? Iron and silicon and carbon and oxygen, all the things that are necessary for life. This is not way out, folks. But our life actually depends on the fact that there were enough supernovas that have gone off in the history of our galaxy to provide the elements here on Earth that we use for life, not to mention for building our buildings, etc. Everything else besides hydrogen and helium, you name it, it was cooked in a supernova. Sagan used to say, I probably have prejudiced the case by saying Sagan used to say, but at any rate, he used to say we are star stuff. And there was a certain truth to that. Okay, now, what does this have to do with the price of eggs? Hold on a second. Here's what I'm trying to say. The galactic position is important because if we were too close to the center, we would have too many supernovas causing destruction for reasons that I mentioned. If we were too far away from the center and the outer fringes of our galaxy, we would not have enough supernovas to provide the material necessary for life on Earth. So our location in the galaxy is just right. I'll say a few things about the Earth's mass. Here's a greenhouse. This, whether the Earth is going to turn into a very hot greenhouse is all the rage these days to discuss. Now, this is the way greenhouses work, at least in this particular illustration. What you've got is the sun irradiates the greenhouse. It's made out of glass, so all the light energy comes in, impinges on the floor, on the plants, on the pots, etc. They warm up and they give off heat energy. But because of the glass, the heat energy cannot dissipate. And so what you have is the greenhouse keeps getting hotter and hotter. And the idea is that this kind of thing could also happen on Earth, not because the Earth is covered with glass, but we have a primary component of what we call a greenhouse gas on the Earth, which is carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide, along with some other gases as well, but primarily carbon dioxide, acts a little bit like the glass in the greenhouse. So here we have the sun with the visible radiation that comes pretty much through the atmosphere, impinges on the Earth, heats up the Earth. The Earth gives off heat rays, so-called infrared radiation. Some of it escapes back into space, which without the greenhouse gas, without the carbon dioxide, some water, and some methane, what you would get is some kind of an equilibrium where you would have as much energy irradiated as you have coming in. But because of the greenhouse gases, some of this energy that would be irradiated out is trapped and forced back down to Earth. And so what you have is a general heating that is going on in the atmosphere. This is a good thing, because otherwise the temperature of the Earth would be barely above freezing. As it is now, we have enough carbon dioxide so that over the course of Earth history, we've had the temperature warm enough to keep water in a liquid form, which is very essential for life on the Earth. So it's important that we have some greenhouse gas, that we have some carbon dioxide on the Earth. But the problem is getting too much carbon dioxide. And the question is, how in the world has the carbon dioxide been controlled over our 3.2 or 4.2 billion years so that the Earth hasn't gotten too warm because of too much carbon dioxide or too cold because of too little carbon dioxide? Where does the carbon dioxide come from? It comes primarily from the interior of the Earth. Here's a picture of a volcano spewing out a lot of gas and dust, a good bit of carbon dioxide. Much more earlier in the Earth's history than what we have now. Far more volcanic action early in the Earth's history than what we have now, which spewed out an enormous amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And in a few moments, I'll mention something that's very interesting that has to do with what the sun has been doing over 5 billion years and what's happened to the carbon dioxide over 5 billion years. But the interesting thing is, there is a huge Earth-wide scale, Earth-wide thermostat that has kept the temperature fairly constant on Earth over billions of years. As a result of that, has been able to keep the Earth at a fairly decent temperature as the carbon dioxide levels differ. And here's basically what's going on. Interestingly enough, if the Earth was too small, we would not have enough atmosphere. If the Earth were one quarter of its mass, we would not have enough atmosphere to hold enough carbon dioxide to give us a greenhouse effect, a necessary greenhouse effect, so that we would have water on the Earth. On the other hand, if the Earth were too massive, basically a factor of two too much, what we would do is have too much carbon dioxide. Because the larger the mass, the heavier the atmosphere, the greater the gravitational pull that the Earth would have on the atmosphere, and you'd be able to hold far more gas, and you would have an enormous amount of carbon dioxide, so much as a matter of fact that the greenhouse effect would be so severe that basically all the water on the Earth would have evaporated by now. The oceans would have boiled. So what has kept it constant? Well, here's what's interesting. Besides having the right kind of mass, continental drift comes into play. That helps us keep the carbon dioxide at a constant level. What I have here is a map that shows the Earth divided up into various sections, given by the various colors. We have known now for quite some time, especially since the 60s, that the surface of the Earth is not constant. There is constant shifting going on. And it's the kind of shifting where huge parts of the crust are moving with respect to other parts of the crust. In some places, one part of the crust is sliding past the other part of the crust. This is what you have here, which raises the earthquakes that you have in the San Francisco area. This kind of a zone. And basically what is happening is this huge plate that is under most of the Pacific Ocean is moving in one direction, and this plate that North America is on, along with a good part of the North Atlantic, is moving in a different direction, and one is crunching past the other and has and raises earthquakes. That has nothing to do with the carbon dioxide. What you do have is two other kind of boundaries, however, and hold on a second. I'm not quite sure how to get rid of this.
Hold the trigger. Pull the trigger and just move. That'll move the mouse. Then you can left click, and it'll be okay.
Like that?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let me try that again. No. Basically, the two kinds of zones that are very interesting in terms of the carbon dioxide level are the kind that you have here in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. In this place, what you have is material oozing up out of the Earth. I'll show you a cross-section of that. Okay, bear with me. There's breadth into my madness here. Material oozing up out of this, like a big crack that's running along the middle of the Atlantic and pushing Africa and Europe to the east and North and South America to the west. But then also what you have over here in the western Pacific is this particular crust, which is butting up against the Pacific plate, that's butting up against the Eurasian plate, is actually diving underneath. It is at those two zones that the carbon dioxide control takes place. And here's the way it happens. Here's a side view that I'm going to give you. First of all, what I'm going to discuss is a reaction, a chemical reaction that takes place that basically removes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And I find if I don't have an equation or some kind of a number on here, nobody takes me seriously. But basically what happens is that the carbon dioxide is absorbed by a very common mineral element, mineral compound here, producing sand and calcium carbonate, which is, should have a calcium carbonate, which is a basically limestone. And basically here's how it works. Here's a side view, cutaway view of the core. Over here is where we have material oozing up, such as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And as it comes up, it pushes one of these plates to the right, another one to the left. Think of this as what is happening in the Middle Atlantic as material oozes up, pushing Africa and Europe to one side and North and South America to the other side. Over here, where material is coming down, as you see over here, where some of the crust now is diving down into the interior of the Earth, this is the place where crust is destroyed. So here it's created, here it's destroyed. I have kind of a version of what's happening here at the boundary where crust is created, and sort of tying together what's going on with when you're boiling water. If you're boiling water, you've got water that's heating up, it becomes less dense, it begins to rise here, as it cools off, it begins to fall. So you've got the circulation going on. Same thing happening in the Earth. Okay, so what? Here's the so what. Here's the cycling that takes place of carbon dioxide that serves as the thermostat for keeping the Earth at a constant temperature. This is a so-called carbon dioxide cycle. What you have is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And carbon dioxide is taken out of the atmosphere through this chemical weathering that takes place. Hold it. Let's see if I've learned this. Very good. I don't have a PhD for nothing. Anyways, what's happening is the carbon dioxide, what happens is some of it is absorbed into the ocean, has been used by objects in the ocean, corals, etc., that use it for shells. When these things die, they come down to the bottom of the ocean and form sediment. Also, you have carbon dioxide that is used up by chemical weathering that takes place just from weathering of the rocks on the continents. That material also then comes as sediment into the ocean. And then that sediment now is subducted by the continental drift, gets down a certain way, melts, and comes back up and releases some of the carbon dioxide. Not all of it, but some of it. This cycle takes about 200 million years. Now, here's the point I'm trying to make here. Here's your thermostat. Because if you get too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you get more evaporation, the temperature heats up, you get more evaporation, more rain, more erosion, more weathering that takes place. That eats up the carbon dioxide as sediment and puts it, locks it up as sediments down in the ocean. All right, suppose that goes too far. And now you have too much carbon dioxide taken off of the atmosphere. And now the danger is not a warming trend on the Earth, but a cooling trend on the Earth that might go too far. 200 million years later, this material is cycled back up and released through volcanic action, or where you have the divergent zones that take place where the material is oozing up from underneath and releases some carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere, which warms it up. So what we have here is a 200 million year thermostat that takes care of the temperature of the Earth. Now, the other interesting thing about this is, if it were not for an accident that occurred very early in the Earth's history, we may not have continental drift, and we may not actually have had this thermostat that takes place. And the event that I'm talking about is the birth of the moon. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, there were quite a number of astronauts that were going to the moon before it got too expensive. They were able to bring back quite a few rocks from the moon. And over several decades of analyzing these rocks, people finally began to figure out how the moon formed. There were various theories as to how the moon formed. And this is the best one that explains the chemical nature of the rocks and why some of them are so similar to the upper part of the crust of the Earth. There's a great similarity there. Basically, around 1976, an astronomer at the University of Arizona, William Hartman, thought that maybe this is the way the moon formed. Early in the Earth's history, when the Earth was pretty much our own size, a huge object that was still floating around in the solar system, and you would have had quite a number of these objects before they were all swept up into the planets, smacked into the Earth, such as you see in this illustration. This is not a CNN photo. This is an illustration of what happened. And here's a sequence of events that gave rise to the moon. Here's the whack on the upper left, the impactor coming in, thought to be about the size of Mars, collided with the Earth at kind of a glancing collision. What that did is stripped off, as you go from left to right, stripped off some material from the upper part of the Earth. The gravitational interaction, you see what's going on as you go from 2 over to 3. Now you get a separate glob that's forming, interacts again with the Earth, and eventually, the long and short of it is, the material that was flung out of the Earth, the upper part of the Earth, formed the moon that you see finally in the lower right photo. Now, the long and short of this is that as a result of this collision, the crust of the Earth is not as thick as it would have been otherwise. If the crust of the Earth were really thick, you wouldn't have continental drift, would not be able to split the crust and move the plates to get the subduction and the oozing up of the material underneath. All you would have is what you have on Venus. And on Venus, what you have is places that are hot spots where material oozes up to the surface, Some of it sinks down and that's it. But as a result of the collision, in the early part of the Earth's history, the crust of the Earth is thin enough so continental drift, so as a result of the collision, as a result of the collision, what you've got is we've got so high tech here, it's incredible. What you have is a result of the collision, what you've got is a thin enough crust for continental drift to take place that gives you a 200 million year thermostat that has kept the temperature fairly constant here on Earth. So as a result of a, quote, accident. Let me say something about the water content of the Earth. The Earth is about 3/4 water, just the right amount of water, in order to keep the Earth from getting neither too hot nor too cold. Water has a very interesting property. First of all, it has a very high heat capacity. And what I mean about that is that you have to add a lot of heat to water in order to raise its temperature. Unlike other things where you add a little heat, the temperature goes up quite a bit. Anybody who tries to boil water quickly recognizes that particular property of water. But as a result of this high heat capacity, what you have is water can absorb a lot of energy and not raise its temperature too high. And then, of course, if things cool down, then that same water that has been warmed up gives off the energy for quite a while. And so the amount of water that we have on Earth also serves as a thermostat for keeping the temperature on the Earth fairly constant over the years that it has been around. So I mentioned the properties of water. Water has a very high heat capacity. It easily evaporates, which is interesting, because that's what keeps us cool in the summer, the evaporation off our skin. But the other interesting thing, too, about water, it's one of these rare properties where the frozen state is actually less dense than the solid state. And basically what happens there, here's a molecular diagram of water as pretty much as a liquid over here to the right. And as it freezes, it grabs a certain structure that actually gives it less density, so the ice floats. I'm saying something that we probably all heard back in late grammar school. It's a good thing that ice floats in the winter, because when the ice forms on top of a lake, if it were more dense, it would be sinking down to the bottom of the lake, and then over winter what you would have is lakes that would be totally solid from ice if ice didn't float. It would freeze from the bottom up rather than from the top down. Since ice forms on top, it provides an insulation to keep the rest of the water from freezing, except, of course, in places where it can get very, very cold. What is the importance of that? Keeps life alive. If the ice was not this way, if the lakes froze from the bottom up, then what you would have is the next spring, as the temperature increases, you get some liquid water up on top. You may not even have a chance to melt it all down to the bottom. And then the next winter, summer, then what you would have is liquid on top, ice on the bottom, and then the whole thing would freeze and start over again the following year. That would not be great for life. So the interesting property of water is instrumental in keeping life alive on Earth and also in keeping the temperature fairly constant. I said something earlier about the Earth's tilt. Let me expand on that somewhat. It's the tilt of the Earth that gives us our seasons. On the top frame, you see what the situation is like in summer. The Earth is pointing towards the sun, and so we have more direct sunlight, so we have summer in the northern hemisphere. In the winter, however, in December, the tilt is away from the sun, and so the light is not quite as concentrated, and as a result, we have less radiation, and hence we have winter. Here's an interesting thing, by the way. At present, what's interesting is that in winter, the Earth is actually closer to the sun than what it is in the summer. So it's the tilt, it's the orientation of the axis towards or away from the sun that's the primary season giver here. For the northern hemisphere, the fact that we are closer to the sun in the winter than what we are in the summer actually helps moderate the temperature a little bit, because we pick up a little bit more radiation because we're closer to the sun, even though we're tilted away, whereas in the summer, when the tilt is towards the sun, we're actually a little farther away. So what it means, our summers are a little cooler and our winters are a little warmer. Now, 12,000 years from now, it's going to be just the opposite for another effect that's going on. But at this point, we have somewhat more moderate, if you're around that long, it's somewhat more moderate at this point than the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. At any rate, the tilt of the Earth gives the seasons. The interesting thing is that the Earth is tilted in a fairly nice way. Here we have a mugshot of the planets and their tilt. Jupiter is almost straight up. By the way, by the tilt, what I mean is the tilt of the axis with respect to the perpendicular to the plane of the orbit. You think of the plane of the orbit as the tabletop, and the tilt of the axis is going to be the angle from the perpendicular down to the tabletop and the actual axis. For the Earth, it's about 22.5 degrees now. Jupiter is only 3 degrees. Most of the planets have a little better tilt. Venus is kind of an oddball, and so is, well, this planet here. No matter how you pronounce it, it sounds bad. Okay, so either Uranus or Uranus. I learned it as Uranus, and that's the way I'm going to pronounce it. At any rate, here's what's interesting. Suppose the tilt of the Earth were like Jupiter. If that were the case, what you would have is you would have fairly consistent seasons throughout the year, because you wouldn't have this big tilt either towards or away from the sun. And what you would have is very hot weather along the equator and very cold weather on the poles. Doesn't mean life couldn't exist, it just wouldn't be as exciting as it is on Earth. Look at this extreme example here, Uranus, where the tilt is almost in the plane of the orbit. I mean, that's almost pathological. Let's contemplate a little bit what the seasons would be like if that were the case. Okay? What we're going to do here, we're going to start right here with, I'm going to start down here. This is basically spring. And we're going to go around counterclockwise, which is the way all planets go as you look at them down from the North Star. In this particular situation, where you've got the pole pointed in the direction that it's in, basically what you would have is a situation where you have a nice normal day-night cycle pretty much throughout the whole planet, except right at the poles. A little light. Okay, we'll do it this way. Right here, except at the poles. So here the Earth is spinning along this axis, and so here you have day-night, fairly reasonable. Now what happens 3 months later, you get to this point, which is summer. Now the axis is pointed directly towards the sun. You have day, perpetual day on the North Pole, perpetual night on the South Pole. What's going to happen to the temperature? You're roasting on the North Pole, if you even exist, because it's going to be so hot, everything's freezing on the South Pole. So if you're living by the North Pole, you're going to be racing towards the equator or the South Pole during summer. Then it comes around again from summer over the fall. Whew, sigh of relief. Now you're getting your regular day-night cycle. However, look at winter. Winter, now you come down here. Now the axis is pointed away from the sun. Now you're freezing at the North Pole and you're boiling at the South Pole. This would make for some very ugly temperature variations and some very ugly climate on Earth if the axis of the Earth were pointing that particular way. Now, what's interesting is that the collision that we think formed the Moon was just right so that the Earth's axis did not flip over too much, such as happened with Uranus. Apparently, it's a collision there that flipped the axis as much as it did. So this is, again, one of those very interesting chance things. Something else about the Earth's moon, besides being quite beautiful, also has a great effect in stabilizing the Earth. And here's what's going on here. First of all, as a result of tidal slowdown, which I'll describe briefly how it happens between the moon and the Earth has slowed down its rotation speed over its history. When it first started out, it may have had a rotation speed of about 15 or 16 hours. In other words, it would rotate once every every 15 or 16 hours. You say, gosh, that sure wouldn't give me a whole lot of time to get any work done during the day. But you would have more days during the year, so you can make up for it. However, the rotation speed would be so fast that, in effect, you could have winds on the... You could have speeds of wind speeds on the Earth about 1,000 miles per hour. Now, we know what happens when you just have 150 miles per hour in a hurricane. But the Earth's rotation would be so fast, it could have 1,000-mile-an-hour wind speeds. Does it mean nothing can exist on Earth? No. It could, but it'd really be hugging the ground. I was up hugging the ground, almost. I was up climbing on the Presidential Range about 2 weeks ago. And we were having gusts that maybe came up to about 60 miles an hour. This is up in the Mount Washington area, which is known for some pretty ugly winds. There are times you balance yourself on a rock and go to take a step, and the wind would push you, and you'd be over. This is 60 miles an hour. So you can imagine what this would be like. Well, it's actually the moon that has slowed us down, and here's how. First of all, the moon raises tides on the Earth. That's no great secret for people who live by the ocean. But at any rate, what happens is the moon is pulling on this part of the Earth with a greater force than the center, and it's pulling on the center with a greater force than what you have on the opposite side of the Earth. And so, as a result, what it wants to do is pull the part of the Earth nearest the moon away from the center, and if you can think of it this way, pull the center away from the far part of the Earth. That's kind of a simple-minded way of seeing how tides form. If the Earth were, the Earth, of course, is not going to deform very much, but the water on the Earth is going to follow the gravitational force. And so you have a bulge of water on the front side of the Earth that's being pulled away from the Earth, and a bulge of water on the back side of the Earth where the Earth is being pulled away from the water. Now, if the Earth were not rotating, which in this case it does counterclockwise, as you look at it from the north, this bulge would line up directly on the line between the two centers, the center of the moon and the center of the Earth. Okay, now, what's interesting, however, is a result of the Earth spinning, it carries this bulge a little in front of this connecting line. And I show that a little better in this case. And basically what you have here then is that this bulge is being pulled back by the moon, and it basically serves as a brake on the Earth. Or if you like, as the Earth spins underneath this bulge of water, the friction between the water and the Earth slows down the Earth. And it's been the slowing down of the Earth that has given us the 24-hour day cycle that we have, that has also slowed down these enormous winds that you would have as kind of a normal phenomenon here on Earth. Something else about the Earth's moon, it stabilizes the Earth's wobble. The Earth spins on its axis, just like a top. All of us have worked with tops. If the top is not spinning, it just goes clunk and falls. However, if the top is spinning and you put it on a table, eventually it goes to fall, but because it's spinning, another force kicks in that keeps it from falling, and what happens is the top does this. It precesses. Well, the Earth is a huge top. It also precesses, such as you see illustrated here. And the interesting thing is that the Earth precesses. It has a period of about 24,000 years of precession. In other words, if the North Pole now, the net result is that the star Polaris is right along the axis of the Earth now, but that's going to change. In about 24,000 years, it'll be back again. So the tilt of the Earth actually sort of shifts back and forth if you were going to look at the Earth constantly over time. But it shifts back and forth, and also the tilt of the Earth changes slightly from about 22 degrees to about 24 degrees. Okay, so you have the tilt, it precesses, basically 22 and a half degrees with respect to the normal, goes maybe to 22 and over to 24. Not much. Look at Mars. This shows the tilt of the axis for Mars. First of all, you've got long-scale tilt here of the axis over the course of about 10 million years, where it can go, the big fat line is over the course of about 10 million years, you have one cycle, and then the vibrations are over the course of about 100,000 years. Mars's tilt in the axis is almost pathological. Instead of being smooth like this, and here I'll try to illustrate it. Instead of being like the Earth, where you have the precession, and then you have some motion, you know, tiny motions in the tilt of the Earth, what you have with Mars is something that looks like this. You know, almost spasmodic. Why? Why is the Earth, by the way, the tilt of the Earth changes, it's about the size of my red dot. At 22.5 degrees, the variations in the Earth tilt is about the size of the line that you would have as I take my red dot all the way across the screen. And Mars can go from about 35 degrees almost down to about 2 degrees. Well, so what? Here's a so what? Just the tiny variations in the tilt that we have on Earth are quite responsible, with other things, but primarily responsible for the ice ages that we've had on Earth. You can actually match up the tilt with the ice ages, the so-called Milankovitch cycles, which ties in other things as well. What keeps the Earth from being so spasmodic? The Moon. The Moon has stabilized not only the rotation speed, slowed down the rotation speed of the Earth, it has also stabilized this very wild, chaotic swinging of the axis, tilting of the axis that you would have as well. Let me just give you a very interesting story. A German astronomer by the name of Sebastian Van Horner was visiting Cornell at one time. That was back when people were trying to figure out what quasars were. Now we think we know what they are. But one of the major problems of trying to figure out what a quasar was to be able to find out exactly where it was in the sky so that optically people could see something visual, because the quasars were being picked up by radio waves. And the way that they did it was that they would look at a part of the sky, wait till the moon's edge went across, and then as the moon came across the line of sight of the quasar, the radio signal would stop. And then they knew, okay, it's someplace along this edge. And then the moon would pass, would occult the radio source, and then when the moon's other edge passed, then they were able to pick up the radio signal again, so they said, okay, it's someplace along now the backside of the moon. And what you would have is two arcs that intersect, so you could say it's either here or there, and then they were able to pin that down and pin down where the quasars were. Well, here's what Van Horner said. He said, you know, the moon is very interesting. About every 18 years, it goes through a cycle covering certain parts of the sky, and we have used it to great benefit. He says, the interesting thing is, we wouldn't want a moon that's too small, because then it wouldn't cover enough of the sky. On the other hand, we wouldn't want it too large, because then it would cover too much of the sky, and it would probably interfere with our studies. He said, if the Lord himself, these are his exact words, he said, if the Lord himself were to come down and talk to astronomers and say, okay, I'm going to design a moon for you, you tell me what you want. He said, well, we would take several months and think about this. He says, and what we would present is a moon just exactly as it is, which I thought was just very fascinating. This is not a raving fundamentalist, by the way, who said this. I mean, he was just giving a story of how helpful the moon had been, which I thought was rather fascinating. What we also have is a... Hold on here. People are going to wonder if I... There we go. The other thing, very briefly, the other thing that has helped the Earth greatly over the course of its history is to have the right kind of star. And here's what I mean by the right kind of star. First of all, it's a single star. If we had most of the stars, by the way, that we see in the galaxy are doubles or triplets. And the problem with that is, it's hard to have stable orbits for planets around stars that are doubles or triplets. And the reason is that the gravitational influence of both of the stars, or the third star, after a while would take the planet and basically fling it out of its orbit. Or else give it such a large elliptical shape to the orbit that the temperature differences through the course of the year would be too profound for life to exist. So we have a single star. We have a star that's not overly active. Every now and then we get some storms from the sun, magnetic storms that affect us on Earth. We get some X-rays, most of them protected by our atmosphere. There are some stars that would throw out so many X-rays from their surface that would basically fry life on Earth. So we have a star that's not overly active. We have a star that isn't too massive. Now, bear with me. Here's what I mean by that. The astronomer's Bible is the so-called HR diagram, where they've taken various stars of various masses and have plotted them, where they plot how bright a star is with its surface temperature. 90% of the stars that you'll see as you look up into the sky fall along this particular line that's called the main sequence. Okay, bear with me here. Here's the sun at this point. Stars that are low and to the right have less mass than the sun. Stars that are up and to the left have more mass than the sun. So far, the sun has been around for about 5 billion years. It'll be around for about another 5 billion more. By the way, at one time I was giving this talk, and I said the sun's going to be around for 5 billion more years, and somebody got very agitated and raised his hand and said, wait, what'd you say? I said, the star will be around for another 5 billion years. He said, oh, good. He says, that calms me. He says, I thought you said 5 million. what we have here is the sun that's been roughly stable for 5 billion years. Now, if we go up and to the left to a star that's only 20% more massive than the sun, it would have burned out by now. Massive stars, even though they have more fuel, burn their fuel proportionally far faster and only need 20% more mass, and the star would be spent by now. And I'll show you what would happen to a star like that. Suppose you go down this way. Here it's less massive. If you get down to about 80% the mass of the sun, you'll have a star that will exist not 10 billion years, but 20 and 30 billion years. The problem is, the stars down here don't give off very much energy compared to the sun, and as a result, the Earth, to have the right temperature, would have to be near the sun, near that particular star. The problem is, it would have to be so near that you would have what we call a tidal lock of the planet with the sun. What does that mean? It's exactly what's happened to the Earth and the Moon, the Earth-Moon system. The Moon constantly, because of the gravitational effect of the Earth upon the Moon, always has one face towards us. We never see the backside. It rotates once on its axis for every time it goes around the Earth. That's what we call by a tidal lock. What would happen to a planet if that were the case? Again, severe temperature differences. It would make the existence of life fairly difficult on Earth. So we have a star that fits at just the right place here. The other thing is, I mentioned that it's not too old, which is a good thing. Here's a schematic of how the sun formed from a large cloud of gas and dust. It condensed into a star, and notice it keeps pretty much the same size, shape, mass, etc. for a very long time, but eventually, 5 billion years from now, the processes in the sun are going to cause it to expand into a red giant. And it's going to be such a giant that the outer part of the star will actually reach the orbit of Mars, which means it will engulf the Earth and its sister planets. This is what would happen to a star that would have been 20% more massive than the sun. This would have already happened and would have engulfed the Earth by now. So we have a star that's just the right age. I show you some other things that happen to stars as they get to the red giant phase. They begin to throw off outer part of atmosphere, shells of very hot material that comes out. And you can imagine if you have planets that were near these stars, this material would interact and wipe out life. So it's another thing that occurs in terms of having life. So we have a right star. Interestingly enough, life has come into play here by also tempering the temperature on Earth. I say here, the slow evolution of the sun was just balanced by the appearance of life so as to keep the temperature of the Earth within acceptable limits. Okay, bear with me here. I mentioned earlier in the Earth's history, we had an enormous amount of carbon dioxide on the Earth. It takes a while for it to get, for our silicon cycle to sequester a good part of that carbon dioxide in the rocks and have it subducted. far more carbon dioxide on the Earth in the beginning than what we have now. More volcanoes, more degas in the interior. How come we didn't have a runaway greenhouse effect at that time? Answer, back then, some 4.5 billion years ago, the sun was only about 3/4 as luminous as it is now. Now, I said our sun is stable. It is for the most part. But as it gets old, it's getting brighter and brighter. And the sun is now 25% brighter than what it was 5 billion years ago, or 4.5 billion years ago. Now, think with me. If the sun back 4.5 billion years ago was as bright as it is now, and we had as much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as we did then, we would have a runaway greenhouse effect. The temperature on the Earth would have gotten to the point where the oceans would have boiled away. Okay, fortunately, what we have is the sun was cooler then, but now over 4.5 billion years, the sun is getting more luminous, 25% brighter. It means 25% more energy hitting the Earth. It means the Earth is going to heat up. If the carbon dioxide level that we had back then was present now, now you would have the combination of high carbon dioxide level and a brighter sun, runaway greenhouse effect, oceans would boil. But the carbon dioxide level has actually decreased from its early history. What did it? One, the carbon dioxide silicon cycle that I mentioned. The other thing, life appeared on Earth at just the right time that began to use up more carbon dioxide in order to bring down the amount of carbon dioxide at just the right level as the sun's energy is increasing, sun's luminosity is increasing, so you have a stable temperature on Earth. That, I think, is kind of neat. Mm-hmm. I have this picture here that sort of tries to illustrate it. Here's a volcano that's spewing out carbon dioxide. We have a clear sky. We have plants that are eating up the carbon dioxide and sort of ties all this together. The silicon carbon dioxide cycle, plants have given us a stable Earth. I also like this picture because I took it myself. Let me just mention a few things briefly and then we will end. We usually don't think of Saturn and Jupiter as anything other than really nice bright planets that are great to see in the sky as evening and morning stars, and they become favorite objects on the part of astronomers, amateur astronomers, to look at through telescope, because you see the bands of Jupiter, you see the ring of Saturn, etc. Interestingly enough, both of these planets, and especially Jupiter, here's a mugshot here of the outer planets and the inner planets, here's Earth, have had a very important role in keeping life stable on Earth. And here's how. By the way, over here on the right, I show you the relative sizes of planets. And here's Earth, and here's Jupiter and Saturn. Here's how. Basically, do you like that? Here, what they do is basically those planets are clear out debris that is in the solar system that was left over from its formation. Not everything has been collected into the existing planets. And we still have what we call space junk out there. I'm not talking about rocket casings that are floating around the Earth, but in the solar system itself, there is a lot of minor bodies that are floating around the solar system, and every now and then they collide with Earth and form a crater. Here's an illustration of the kind of material that you have. Jupiter and Saturn keep asteroids and comets at bay. Basically, here's a diagram that shows you some of the asteroids. This is material between Mars and Jupiter with orbits, so-called Earth-crossing orbits. By the way, this red line is not Earth. That is Mars, and the blue line here is Earth. This diagram over here is mislabeled. Here it's labeled correctly. Red is Mars, blue is Earth. Notice that you actually have some asteroids that can get close to the Earth. And every now and then there's a scare because an asteroid only comes within a few million miles of Earth. One of the big catastrophic scenarios that people talk about is an asteroid or a comet whacking the Earth with such intensity that it wipes out life. 65 million years ago, we had a huge collision down in the Yucatan Peninsula that is thought to have wiped out the dinosaurs. How intense was the collision? The crater that was initially left after the collision was about 90,000 feet deep. I mean, you're talking a little less than 20 miles. I mean, you've been to the Grand Canyon and looked down a mile. multiply that by about a factor of 18. And this is what we're talking about, several hundred miles across. Something like that is very destructive because not only the shock waves that are raised up on Earth, but also the atmospheric effects, fires, sun not being able to shine brightly on the Earth, etc. Very devastating. What has kept a good number of these kind of scenarios from occurring on Earth has been Jupiter and Saturn that act like slingshots and basically fling the material out. This is Meteor Crater in Arizona. This was a small meteor. This is only about a half mile across. This is a small meteor. And here's the crater that it raised. Here's a little building right here to get some perspective. Here's a real possibility. And admittedly, I got this off a prophecy brochure. But on the other hand, this shows the kind of thing that happened, maybe not quite at this intensity, but down here in the Yucatan Peninsula, down this area, that was powerful enough to bring darkness to the Earth and basically wipe out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Life has been fairly stable on Earth because we don't have a whole lot of these things occurring, and the reason is the gravitational effect of Jupiter and Saturn is able to fling these things out of the solar system and keep them from coming in towards the interior in such large numbers where we have a great number of collisions here on Earth. Let me conclude briefly here. I have a very interesting quote by Freeman Dyson, physicist at Princeton Institute for Advanced Studies. Not a Christian. He says, as we look out into the universe, do you have another tape or? As we look out into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked together to our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe must be, in some sense, have known we were coming. Very interesting. Here's what Psalm says. Thou, Lord, in the beginning has laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. I think we see both things in play here. Some other conclusions. The evidence for design, I think, is there. I'm not putting probabilities on these things, but it's just interesting that so many things like this happen to work in just the right way so that life can exist here on Earth for as long as it has. For design, evidence for design is here. I think the evidence can enhance our conceptions of Jesus Christ. Notice it says here in Colossians 1:16, all things have been created through him and for him. And we see some of the cleverness and some of the power that's involved in this creation. John 1:3, all things came into being through him. Again, I think the study of these kinds of evidence help us appreciate Jesus more and what he has done in creation as well, certainly, as what he has done in redemption in our lives. The other thing is that's important. The evidence is there to convict us if we refuse to listen. Going back to Romans 1 again. And with that, I will call it quits. Thank you very much. I will answer questions if you're willing to. I mean, you don't have to hang around. If you have to leave, I can certainly understand that. But if you have some questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Yes, sir.
Do you believe, what's your opinion of global warming, and is it possible that it's man-caused?
The evidence for global warming is certainly there. How much of it is human, however, certainly some part of it. I think the big debate is whether it's enough that we should really get as concerned as some people say we should be or not. I do know one thing, that if you look back in the history of the Earth, long times ago, it's actually been warmer than what it is now. And carbon dioxide levels have actually been higher than what they are now, interestingly enough. The other thing, I mentioned a man's name by the name of Milankovitch. He's the one who worked out the change in climate, not only due to changes in the tilt of the Earth, but the Earth being closer and farther away from the sun, precession. He puts all these things together and built a graph and said, this is the amount of sunlight that you can expect in the northern hemisphere at various latitudes throughout hundreds of thousands, back several hundred thousand years. Interestingly enough, that correlates very nicely. The low points where you have the minimum amount of energy reaching the northern hemisphere, at those low points is where you have the ice ages. Now, I bring that up because, interestingly enough, according to Milankovitch, if you carry his calculations forward, we should actually be at a sloping down period. We actually are should be heading into an ice age rather than into a warming period. So my answer to that is, yes, the Earth is warming. How much of it is human caused, I don't know. And whether billions of dollars should be spent to try to reduce the temperature, which some people have brought out, would basically, over 50 years, reduce the temperature rise from about 1.9 degrees to about 1.6 degrees centigrade. And we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars being spent for that. Whether that should be done, I'm skeptical, personally.
The argument that you gave about the how the moon was formed because it was a part of the Earth where the identifiable with the material on the moon.
Right.
So there was some stone out there that hit the Earth and took a part of it and went out there. Normally, when there's an impact, it's because of the gravity, and wouldn't it just stay where it's at, just create like a creator and become one with it rather than simply go out?
It could if it was a dead-on hit, but the problem is it's somewhat of a glancing hit, and you've got to absorb the momentum somehow, and so it's not just going to hit and stop. It sort of keeps moving on, taking material with it. Some of it is then held by the gravity of the Earth, and begins to rotate around the Earth, interacts with the Earth a couple more times, and eventually you get the moon that's forming. Now the other thing is it's. The other thing that's interesting here is there are certain elements that are missing from the moon, certain moon rocks, certain volatile elements. That is, elements that at high temperatures will evaporate. And this was one of the real questions people had. Why are these particular elements, these low-temperature volatiles, so-called, missing from the moon rock? And they would say, somehow this whole thing got heated up at one time, and these things then evaporated. And that's part of the other reasoning for why we think the moon actually formed from a collision. Okay. But I did mention that during the talk. But anyway, in answer to your question, a lot of it depends on the angle, on the speed, et cetera, as to whether everything's going to hit and basically fuse, or whether some of it's going to get flung off, and then how much of that is actually going to be kept and condensed into another body that rotates the initial body.
Okay, two parts to this question, considering that. Is there any evidence anywhere at all where a stone hit a planet and just went off like that there without impacting and becoming one with it? And if this is the moon, why would it remain round like it is, not just maybe half a stone floating out there?
Yeah, good question.
What would keep it from... if it hit it like that with an impact and go on, just continue on rather than stop at a certain point and rotate around the Earth?
Yeah, those are good questions. First of all, the reason the moon is round is because there was a large enough body that it melted. And so as a result, it was able to coalesce into a sphere the way a drop of water would. And then later, by the way, impacts on the moon that give us the craters that we have on the moon. In answer to your question, why would it stay around? What you have is you do have the gravitational force of the Earth that is able to hang on to some of the material. I mean, when you have a collision, what you're going to have is you're going to have very high energy transfer to some of the material that really is going to go shooting off. But you're going to have a spread of energy of the material that is flying off as a result of the collision. Some of the stuff that's not going too quickly is going to fall right back into the Earth. Some of the stuff that's going very quickly is going to escape the gravitational field of the Earth. Now you have the in-between stuff that is going to have enough energy so that you can actually combine that with the gravitational pull of the Earth. And remember, the Earth is spinning also. It's still spinning very early in its history. So stuff that's hit is not only going to fly out, but it also has a rotational component to it. And eventually it coalesces and begins to go in orbit. And then after time, by the way, the tendency, even if you have a very elliptical orbit through a collision like that, the tendency is to circularize the orbit for the most part. So mechanically, kinematically, it does work out that you can do something like this. Now, you might say, why, in answer to the other question, what about something that just makes a grazing collision and flies off? Actually, that happens to the Earth several times, where you get meteorites, much smaller than the impactor that produce the moon, but meteorites that actually come, and they're a little bit like a stone skipping across water. They come, they interact with the atmosphere, they go through part of it, and basically then fly off, and what you see is this very bright flash going across the sky, so-called bolides. I have to tell you my experience with one. I was at Kitt Peak Observatory one night, and I was going down to get a bite to eat. My dad was right, by the way. He was an astronomer, at least back then. He really did spend a lot of time in cold observatories, and he did not get paid much, especially as a graduate student. But at any rate, I was because it's an observatory, they don't like people to have their lights on, obviously, because people want darkness to take their photos and all that. I'm walking down with my friend, and all of a sudden I see my shadow. And I'm turning around saying, what idiot turned his lights on? It turned out to be a bolide. Mm-hmm. The meteorite that was so bright, I actually saw my shadow before I actually saw. And this again was sort of went across the sky, and it comes into the atmosphere at a level above the Earth, burns up while it's going through the atmosphere because of the enormous friction that's going on, and then escapes and off it goes. Uranus, the planet that got knocked on its side, a huge collision, undoubtedly at that point. That caused our theories of the creation of the planets is that most of them should have their tilt should not be pathological like Uranus. So and basically apparently what happened there is a good sized impactor hit whatever was first forming, and in that case was able to knock it over and basically keep things that way. So we see those kinds of things that are happening. We see the pot marks on asteroids. I mean, the name of the game in the solar system is collision after collision. We're lucky here because the atmosphere protects us from a good part of that. And we're also lucky because Jupiter and Saturn protect us from huge collisions that could occur here on Earth.
Yeah.